Sony's first new handheld gaming device in 7 years came out yesterday, the PlayStation Vita. Vita is the Latin word for life, and after suffering a series of tough blows, including the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, and a significant hacking attack on Sony, the Vita is just what Sony needs, some new life. NPR's Nina Gregory has more.
I'm here!
There!
Everywhere!
And the world is in flames!
The PlayStation Vita went on sale at a Best Buy here in Los Angeles yesterday morning, and despite the company's $50 million marketing campaign, only about a dozen gamers were on hand. Among those ambling in, 38-year-old Tyler Hinkle.
Well, it comes down to I'm a nerd and I pretty much have to have one.
Though Hinkle had never played one, he knew all about it. The Vita's got some of the most cutting-edge technology, touch screens on the front and the back, so you can use all your fingers to navigate through a game. It also has front and back cameras that enable gamers to incorporate the world around them into a game. Still, the Vita is up against some pretty serious competition. Here's industry analyst Jack Plunkett.
Well, the product is absolutely cool, but it has to be absolutely cool because the competition from other platforms is so daunting.
The competition is not just other handheld gaming devices, but consoles and mobile phones. Jack Trenton is the CEO of Sony Computer Entertainment America. Naturally, he says playing on the Vita is better than playing on a phone.
I think the first thing you're going to notice when you hold the Vita in your hand is this is a device that was built for gaming. When you hold a smartphone in your hand, you say, oh, in addition to dialing the phone, I can take advantage of some minor gaming expertise with this.
Analyst Jack Plunkett says the Vita is aimed squarely at a certain group of consumers.
It's a pure game machine aimed at absolutely avid gamers who want to spend some real money on it. And that's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Sony desperately needs the PlayStation Vita to be a hit because the company has been losing money for years. Again, Jack Plunkett.
It's potentially a real redeemer for the company, and based on everything I've seen, they have a really good chance with it.
But success will be a tall order. Analyst Plunkett says Sony needs to sell at least 50 million of the devices and at least half a billion games over the next 5 years. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
NPR's business news starts with online privacy concerns. The White House is announcing a new effort today to protect online consumer privacy. The administration is asking internet companies and privacy advocates to work out voluntary standards and abide by a so-called privacy bill of rights. NPR's Steve Henn has more.
Most modern Americans know they're being observed online, but figuring out exactly how all this works is tough. Jonathan Mayer studies online tracking at Stanford.
And this can show up in some remarkably sensitive contexts.
As more companies like Google and Facebook tie our web surfing habits to our social profiles, it all gets dicier.
The UK National Health Service for quite some time had Facebook's like button on its disease pages. So if you went to research a medical condition, Facebook not only learned that some user had gone to that page, they actually learned it was you in particular. They know because you have a Facebook account.
Every big web browser allows users to opt out of third-party tracking. Apple's Safari browser is set to block it by default. But last week, Jonathan Mayer caught Google circumventing Apple's built-in privacy protections.
So it didn't matter whether you had a Google account or not, whether you were logged into that account or not.
The White House's Deputy Chief Technology Officer, Daniel Weitzner, says the fact that millions of Americans are having these kinds of experiences online inspired today's announcement.
They set their web browsers one way. They think they have control over their personal information, and it ends up they don't. That's why principle number one in our Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights is the principle of individual control.
Yesterday, the digital advertising industry pledged to push ahead with a do not track option on web browsers that would actually work. And the White House is asking companies to be more transparent about what data they're collecting online and how they'll use it. Companies will have to keep data secure and allow us to inspect our own information, even correct mistakes. But for now, at least, these proposed privacy rights won't have the force of law. Instead, the White House is asking businesses and consumer groups to sit down together and hash out voluntary standards.
I think the White House is coming to the rescue of one of America's most important industries.
Jeff Chester is at the Center for Digital Democracy.
Right now, companies like Facebook and Google are very worried that it'll be the European privacy policy, which requires much greater consumer control, that will become the dominant global standard.
The U.S. has no comprehensive digital privacy law, and European regulators are pushing U.S. firms to offer greater privacy protections. Chester says that by getting behind these voluntary U.S. standards, the industry will gain a bit of cover. Still, companies that make these privacy commitments will have to live by them.
One of the most critically important things is that these standards are enforceable.
John Leibowitz is chairman of the Federal Trade Commission.
They're enforceable because if a company says, we are not going to track information, then a failure to do that could be a deceptive act or practice.
The FTC's record of enforcing voluntary industry agreements like this is mixed. Last fall, the agency forced Google and Facebook to sign consent decrees, promising to better protect consumer privacy. But already, many consumer groups believe Google has violated that deal, and they're pressuring the FTC to act again. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
NPR's business news starts with online privacy concerns. The White House is announcing a new effort today to protect online consumer privacy. The administration is asking internet companies and privacy advocates to work out voluntary standards and abide by a so-called privacy bill of rights. NPR's Steve Henn has more.
Most modern Americans know they're being observed online, but figuring out exactly how all this works is tough. Jonathan Mayer studies online tracking at Stanford.
And this can show up in some remarkably sensitive contexts.
As more companies like Google and Facebook tie our web surfing habits to our social profiles, it all gets dicier.
The UK National Health Service for quite some time had Facebook's like button on its disease pages. So if you went to research a medical condition, Facebook not only learned that some user had gone to that page, they actually learned it was you in particular. They know because you have a Facebook account.
Every big web browser allows users to opt out of third-party tracking. Apple's Safari browser is set to block it by default. But last week, Jonathan Mayer caught Google circumventing Apple's built-in privacy protections.
It didn't matter whether you had a Google account or not, whether you were logged into that account or not.
The White House's Deputy Chief Technology Officer, Daniel Weitzner, says the fact that millions of Americans are having these kinds of experiences online inspired today's announcement.
They set their web browsers one way. They think they have control over their personal information, and it ends up they don't. That's why principle number one in our Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights is the principle of individual control.
Yesterday, the digital advertising industry pledged to push ahead with a do not track option on web browsers that would actually work. And the White House is asking companies to be more transparent about what data they're collecting online and how they'll use it. Companies will have to keep data secure and allow us to inspect our own information, even correct mistakes. But for now, at least, these proposed privacy rights won't have the force of law. Instead, the White House is asking businesses and consumer groups to sit down together and hash out voluntary standards.
I think the White House is coming to the rescue of one of America's most important industries.
Jeff Chester is at the Center for Digital Democracy.
Right now, companies like Facebook and Google are very worried that it'll be the European privacy policy, which requires much greater consumer control, that will become the dominant global standard.
The U.S. has no comprehensive digital privacy law, and European regulators are pushing U.S. firms to offer greater privacy protections. Chester says that by getting behind these voluntary U.S. standards, the industry will gain a bit of cover. Still, companies that make these privacy commitments will have to live by them.
One of the most critically important things is that these standards are enforceable.
John Leibowitz is chairman of the Federal Trade Commission.
They're enforceable because if a company says, we are not going to track information, then a failure to do that could be a deceptive act or practice.
The FTC's record of enforcing voluntary industry agreements like this is mixed. Last fall, the agency forced Google and Facebook to sign consent decrees, promising to better protect consumer privacy. But already, many consumer groups believe Google has violated that deal, and they're pressuring the FTC to act again. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Social media and smartphones have transformed how Americans meet and mate. Technology is also changing how couples split up. When people have affairs or misbehave, they leave not just a paper trail, but an electronic one that's just as incriminating. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on a new survey of divorce lawyers, and it reveals a big rise in the use of text messages as evidence in court.
Americans carefully craft our public image on Facebook. We edit emails, spell checking, rewriting. But text messages? Ken Altshuler, head of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, says we don't give those much thought.
So what happens is a lot of people will draft a text at the spur of the moment, feeling hot and bothered about something, and off goes the text message, but it's the same kind of written documentation that lawyers just love to go to town on.
More than 80% of divorce lawyers report an increased use of text messages in court. And Altshuler says once your words are in print, they're hard to disown.
I had one husband, frankly, who said in a text message, "I'm so angry at you right now, I could kill you." And he got charged with criminal threatening.
Just as with things we say, these little missives can be taken out of context, but they can also reveal a stark truth. Altshuler says they're key to cross-examination, a way to undermine someone's credibility. Take this text to a secret lover.
"We had a great time in Boston. I can't wait to see you again." And of course, you know, the person in that case said he was on a business trip in Denver.
In one custody battle, Altshuler says a text message single-handedly won the case. The mother claimed the father's drinking problem compromised his parenting. But the father was an excellent witness. He said he hadn't drunk in a year, and even his substance abuse counselor vouched for him. Classic he said, she said. Until Altshuler's client displayed a recent text from her husband asking her to pick up beer on the way home.
He sat there and stared at the text message for about 2.5 minutes. He had no answer. Case is over.
Some people have text messages that go back years. It depends on the size of the phone.
Stephen Ward is a private investigator with Pinkerton. He says as technology improves, so does the potential for texts as evidence.
If you actually look at the cell phones now, the size of the phone's memory is what most standard desktops were about 2 to 3 years ago.
A treasure trove of information, Ward says. But getting texts into court as evidence can be tricky, especially if it's a spouse's text you're after. If you've stolen a password to access them, they can be ruled inadmissible. And if they're on a company phone, watch out, says Ward.
You could be looking at things that are trade secrets that you're not entitled to see, that's actually corporate property, it's not yours, and you've done something completely illegal.
Ward says it's always best to let a lawyer subpoena a spouse's texts. But even using messages from your own phone isn't always a sure thing. Lee Knott tried to submit texts from her ex-husband during a custody battle. She used an app to send them to her email account.
And so each text message, even if it was only 4 words long, ended up taking a page. So that's hundreds of pages.
Knott says she got the sense the judge in a rural part of Washington state was overwhelmed and wary.
The judge said that he didn't understand the technology and that he could not be certain that it wasn't able to be tampered with.
In fact, some states only accept electronic evidence if it's been gathered by a professional. Lawyers love getting their hands on these smoking gun texts, but for their own clients, they have one overriding piece of advice. Don't write anything you don't want a judge to read. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. There is a civil war going on in California. It's the South versus the North. Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. The cause? Intellectual property rights. One of the highest profile battles was fought last month when large internet sites such as Wikipedia staged an online blackout. They were protesting anti-piracy bills in Congress. Silicon Valley won that battle. For now, the legislation is on hold. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the conflict is far from over.
In the South, Hollywood. There are the people making their livings off of music, movies, and TV. Southerner Gavin Pallone is an executive producer on such shows as The Gilmore Girls and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
What is the key element? Is that a movie or a television show or a song or a book is actually someone's property?
And to Pallone and other Southerners, taking that property without permission is a criminal act. That's why Hollywood has used the law to try and shut down the revolving door of sites that traffic in music, movies, television, and film, from Napster to Mega Upload. But up north in Silicon Valley, in the hub of technological innovation and newly minted millionaires and billionaires, techies like Tim O'Reilly have a different view.
I'm a creature of a technology world where you accept a high level of competition and you don't have a lot of respect for businesses protecting their turf except by innovating.
O'Reilly is founder of a publishing company that's part of O'Reilly Media. It publishes technology-oriented ebooks on topics like how to get the most out of your iPad 2 or how to program iOS 5.
If things are being pirated, people want them. And I would far rather have one of my products discover that it's highly pirated than that it isn't, because what that tells me is a lot of people want it.
In fact, O'Reilly says a study of his customers proved that many paid later for what they at first took.
We found that the people who pirated were actually also the people who paid us more. They had a budget.
But ebooks are also advertisements for O'Reilly's other products, tech classes, and business conferences. Less than 50% of his company's income comes from ebooks. Making a movie is another kind of project altogether. Take an independent film like Suing the Devil, starring Malcolm McDowell as the devil himself.
How many people are going to sue me and blame me because they can't get their act together, huh?
Tim Che directed the film, and he knows exactly what it cost to make.
Each camera costs $150,000 with all the setups and everything. So we're talking $300,000 just on the camera. Then we have sound, we have special effects.
And the list goes on. Che has a law degree from Harvard, but he's not rich, and he doesn't spend his time thinking about business models. He and his colleagues put their innovations into their films.
We do it for the art. We do it because we want to tell our stories, express our stories. I, as a filmmaker, am not in it for the money.
But he's got to pay his bills. So when he saw his film up on the internet for free before it was even released...
It can make you cry as a filmmaker. It can make you cry. I mean, all of that work.
But what made him want to take legal action was when he asked the website Pirate Bay to take down his film.
The guy wrote back and said this: "We've never taken any of our movies off of our site. Why would we take yours off?"
Appropriation of intellectual property has always existed. The internet just makes it easier, says Ben Huh, the CEO of Cheeseburger Network, a company that runs a group of popular sites featuring amateur humor like lolcats, funny captions over pictures of cats. Huh says content creators and the government need to start thinking differently.
It's almost like we're entering prohibition again, where the public perception towards copyright no longer matches the legal perception of copyright.
Like most techies, he starts talking about business models and giving customers what they want to minimize the number of people who steal. If people don't want to go to the movie theater to see the latest film, Huh says they should be able to see it at home legally.
And I'll pay you extra so I don't have to schlep my butt out in the snow, sit with a bunch of teenagers who talk behind me and use their cell phone. Why does that not exist?
In the end, these two industries may need each other more than they currently realize. This year, Google's YouTube commissioned professionals in Hollywood and New York to create channels on the site because the folks at Google didn't have the talent or expertise. Southerner Gavin Pallone thinks eventually the Northerners will start to see the situation differently as they see how much it costs to make high-quality content.
They'll be the same as these media companies that they're rallying against right now. And they will also start to look at this very expensive property as property, and they're not going to want to have it stolen from them.
But both sides continue to wage war using the weapons they know best, whether it's the courts or the internet. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This week we're going to talk about national policy on web privacy. And President Obama proposed a national policy, and we're going to talk about whether it's going to be working or not, and what kinds of things have been left out, how you can protect your privacy. We're also going to be talking about a shrinking transistor, the basic building blocks of computers. There is news that a bunch of scientists have created a transistor out of a single atom, one transistor, one atom. And, you know, if you can shrink those down into one chip, the holy grail of making powerful computers is to get as many transistors as you can on one chip, of course, without melting the chip, because each of those transistors gives off a lot of heat when you get billions of them stuck together. And also, we're going to talk about the moon. Is the moon quite dead as we thought? But it's not dead yet, because there's actually evidence of activity on the far side of the moon, recent activity, and I guess in geological timescale, 50 million years is recent activity. So first we're going to let's go right to the moon, the transistor piece. And waiting to talk with us about that transistor piece is who do we have on the front? Michelle Simmons, of course. Michelle Simmons is here. She is a lead author on the report of the journal Nature Nanotechnology. She's professor of physics at the University of New South Wales, and she joins us by phone from Sydney, Australia, where it's really early in the morning, and we want to thank you, Dr. Simmons, for getting up early to talk to us.
That's a pleasure.
Now, you actually have built a transistor out of a single atom.
That's right. We've actually put down a single atom as the functional element of a transistor. So we've put a phosphorus atom into silicon, and the phosphorus atom has one extra electron compared to silicon, and we actually use that phosphorus atom as essentially the on and off states of the transistor.
And so on and off state meaning you can store ones and zeros in the
computer. Instead, in conventional computing, you switch it between on and off, and that's the one and zero. But when you get down to a single atom, you start to actually look at the energy levels of that single atom, and you conduct when the energy levels of the single atom are aligned with the source and the drain leads, and you're insulating when they're not aligned.
Mm. So we're not talking about quantum computing here, are we?
Well, essentially, that's what we're heading for. So in our team here in Australia, we're actually trying to build the kind of functional element, the unit cell of a quantum computer using that phosphorus atom, yes.
Mm-hmm. And now that you've gotten one atom, you need to have billions of them, don't you, to really make a functioning computer?
No. So for classical computing, yes, you absolutely have billions of transistors on a chip.
Mm-hmm.
For quantum computing, it's predicted that you only need tens to hundreds of atoms in order to be able to do a quantum computation.
Mm-hmm. So in your quest to do quantum computation, you don't need as many.
Hopefully you don't need as many, yeah, that's right.
I like the way you said hopefully.
Yeah. So one of the big challenges for quantum computation is to build up the number of the fundamental units. They call them quantum bits or qubits. And basically, if you want to make a quantum computer, you have to build up these number of qubits to make a functional system. And one of the big questions internationally is how big can you keep quantum coherence across those qubits?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the critical thing. And if you have to have billions of them, then it's quite likely it's going to be very difficult to do that. But if you only need hundreds of them, it's quite likely you should be able to keep the coherence across the whole system.
So then you have to physically place, sort of by hand, each one of those single atoms to make your computer?
So if you want to make, using the route that we're taking now, where we're using the electron, the extra electron on the phosphorus atom as the qubit, then eventually you do need to be able to scale that up. And that means that you have to place each individual phosphorus atom with atomic precision within the silicon crystal.
And how difficult is that?
Well, I guess the paper that we've just published is really the first time where anyone's been able to put that phosphorus atom in with, one lattice spacing precision, and then align the electrodes to the atom to be able to measure its electronic energy levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've done it for one, and now that we've developed the technology to do it for one, actually the technology we've developed is actually very easy to go from one to two to three to four to five. So we're very hopeful that it's going to be possible. But like I say, the big question is whether the actual material allows you to keep this quantum coherence over a large distance or not.
That really
comes down to nature, whether it will happen or
not. Can you explain that a little bit more to us, what the difficulty there is?
So if you imagine in the real world, you're using an electron in a transistor,
right,
and you're carrying charge. So you switch, like we said, between on and off state. So it's like, you can kind of imagine a tennis ball. You throw it against the wall, and it bounces back in the real world, and you understand that. And it's quite a robust system. Whereas when you make things very, very small, you enter the quantum world, and instead of looking at it as a kind of physical object, you start to look at it as a wave-like object. And there you can imagine if the tennis ball was very, very small and you throw it against the wall, it would actually come out the other side, so it would tunnel through in the quantum world when you make things small. And I guess that's the critical thing, is in the quantum world, things behave counterintuitively and very differently to the way we expect. And in the quantum world, you really want to be able to control those quantum states. And they're much more fragile, much more able to interact with other things around them.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been working on this?
It's a 10-year program so far. So we started about 10 years ago with the idea, could we make a single atom transistor, and then could we actually start to measure, instead of the charge of the atom, the electron, we actually measure the electron spin. And so really that's what we've been doing very recently, starting to measure the spin state of the electron. But the question at the beginning was, can you actually make it? Can you adapt the technology that exists out there to be able to put a single atom in with that kind of precision and then measure its energy levels electronically?
So can you give me an idea of the steps now that you need to go through in order to make something practical?
Yeah, well, so the technology we've developed is we take a silicon wafer, which you normally get from industry, and we put down a hydrogen layer on the surface that acts as a kind of a mask state. And then we come along with a very fine metal tip in a scanning tunneling microscope. That's a very fine metal tip that we use to pattern the hydrogen layer, where we open up regions on the surface where we desorb the hydrogen and expose the silicon underneath. And then we bring in our precursor, bring in the phosphorus atoms. We use phosphine gas, and that will only adhere to the holes in the resist layer. And so in such a way, we actually pattern the phosphorus into the silicon on that one atomic surface. And then we encapsulate that with silicon. And so basically the phosphorus atoms will stay where we've patterned them on the surface, and then we encapsulate them in a nice, robust, crystalline environment of silicon that keeps it protected from the outside world.
It's like a silicon sandwich you got there with phosphorus.
It is, yeah. So the phosphorus is really nicely protected inside, and it's surrounded by lots of silicon atoms. That really, we call it the host material, and that really protects it. And so really when we're going to expand to larger numbers of qubits, we literally use the same process. Instead of patterning a hole for one phosphorus atom, we will pattern a hole for many phosphorus atoms at the same time.
And why phosphorus? What's unique about phosphorous that you've chosen that?
Well, so phosphorus is great, but there's a couple of reasons. The first one is it literally has one extra electron compared to silicon. So silicon has 4 electrons in its outer shell, phosphorus has 5. And so when you put phosphorus in silicon, 4 of those electrons are used to bond to the silicon atoms, and the extra one is free. And that extra one is what we use as the conventional bit, the quantum bit or qubit. So that's one reason. The other reason why we use phosphorus in silicon is that silicon itself is a nice host material, so it has no free spins in it. So all the electrons are used for bonding, and so they basically don't interact with that one extra electron, whereas the phosphorus just literally has one extra electron, which we then control in the quantum bit or qubit.
You know what I'm picturing here? If you're talking about using a few hundred, a few thousand of these electrons, and you're depositing them one at a time, and I'm sort of a picture. You could make your logo out of the
that's exactly what people have done. So the technique of scanning tunneling microscopy is about 30 years old now. It was invented in the U.S. By some researchers at IBM, and they actually pretty quickly realized that they could pick up atoms on a surface and put them down in different locations, and they actually formed the world's smallest logo, IBM, out of individual atoms. But they were picking up atoms and placing them on a surface. And I guess that's been a great technique, and they've done lots of beautiful studies of that. But really what we're trying to do is to adapt the same kind of technology to a silicon device. And the key difference there is in silicon, all the atoms bond very, very strongly in the surface, so you can't pick them up and place them. And this is why we've had to kind of develop this technique with the hydrogen resist layer.
Right.
To open up a little hole and then put phosphorus atoms in.
Now we know why it's impressive to have small things like the size of an atom, but does that also help you speed things up at that level that you're working at?
Well, so I mean, conventionally the silicon industry, the devices get smaller, and because they're smaller, the electrons have less distance to travel, so essentially they get faster, and that's really what's pushed the existing semiconductor industry. I guess in the world of quantum computing, you're actually using a completely different way of doing the computing. So you're using what's called parallelism, quantum parallelism. So instead of doing calculations in the classical world one after the other, albeit very fast, you actually do these calculations in parallel. And there are certain kinds of calculations where if you can do things in parallel, you can get a predicted exponential speed up in the computation. And I guess that's one of the reasons why quantum computation is quite an exciting field at the moment. If you can actually realize them, then there are certain tasks that you can do that would just be much faster than you can do with classical computers.
And finally, what advantage did you have in beating everybody else to doing this?
Look, I think we're partly because we looked at a very long-term project. So we, with the Australian Research Council here, and we actually get funding from the U.S. Army Research Office, we set up this program 10 years ago with the view that it was going to be at least a 10-year project. Mm-hmm. So having funding for a long period of time, sustained funding, has been essential. But I guess also we got into the field when a lot of people were not in the silicon field. So we basically got in right at the beginning and said, look, you know, you can watch Moore's Law, which is the more that right. kind of dictates the silicon industry, and you can see that, you know, within a couple of decades from the time that we started, that we're going to hit the level of single atoms. Mm-hmm. And so we basically said, we're going to literally look at the technology that exists out there and adapt it to make devices in silicon. And I think it was just that we were looking a long term ahead, and with the view that we were going to have relatively sustained funding. So we just literally went for it.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in touch. Dr. Michelle Simmons is the lead author in the report in the journal Nature Technology. She's also director of the Australian Center of Excellence for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology, professor of physics at the University of New South Wales, joining us from Sydney, Australia. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about digital privacy. President Obama, the White House, announced a proposed policy for digital privacy. What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll talk to you right after the break. Stay with us.